This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, triumph at the Cup for the owners of Vow and Declare. But even in Melbourne, some refuse to celebrate as awareness grows of what happens to some former racehorses. Our reporter assesses the changing attitudes. And forget the smartphone. Imagine if secret directions were hidden in a song. For Aboriginal Australians, they're called song lines, and elders are starting to translate their ancient knowledge.
So from a blank canvas map to seeing this extraordinary, map, you witness the way that the elders are sort of telling younger people about where their places are and discussing the dreaming tracks that connect them. It's incredibly exciting.
That's ahead tonight on PM. But let's start with the Disability Royal Commission, which has today been debating whether there is a place for so-called special schools in Australia's education system. Tens of thousands of Australian children with disabilities are separated out to get their education in these kinds of schools. But there's a push to phase them out. Advocates say students are better off in mainstream schools. But what about the impact on teachers who are, as the inquiry heard today, stretched beyond the limit of human capacity with their current workload? Julia Holman reports.
The Royal Commission today heard from a Townsville mum of five. All of her children have disabilities. For legal reasons, we can't give you her name, but she described the frustration of trying to get schools and teachers to educate her kids.
It can be incredibly difficult to get teachers to make adjustments because of teachers' lack of knowledge and lack of understanding.
The witness, who herself is a special education teacher, told the hearing she wanted her kids to be taught at mainstream schools, but she said she had to fight to get the support that they need.
It's absolutely exhausting and frustrating and unnecessary.
Tens of thousands of Australian students with disabilities aren't in the mainstream system and are instead taught in special schools. There's nearly 500 special schools nationally, and some disability advocates want them phased out. But the head of the Queensland Education Union says it's important for parents to have the choice of a special school.
If you make, for example, a blanket decision to take away special schools as an option, it denies the system and parents and those students one of the suite of options for providing effective education.
Kevin Bates told the hearing that the education system isn't resourced for all students with disabilities to be taught in mainstream schools.
Until such time as we achieve our goals of limitless resources for our schools to provide the services that children need, we're probably going to have to look at some unfortunate compromises around some of those outcomes.
And he claimed teachers are already overworked, and expecting them to teach even more special needs students is stretching them too thin.
The current expectations on teachers have already reached the limit of human capacity. Adding additional expectations would stretch us well beyond that.
I actually really disagree that all teachers are in that kind of situation where, they're being stretched beyond what is humanly capable.
Linda Graham is a professor at the School of Early Childhood and Inclusive Education at the Queensland University of Technology.
Some teachers most definitely are, but there are an awful lot of teachers who are not pulling their weight.
Can you tell me why, in your view, special schools should be phased out?
First of all, the evidence suggests that inclusive education is superior in terms of outcomes for children. Second, children with a disability have a right to an inclusive education under the Convention for the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. Third, it's a very, very expensive model to run. The other final reason is because with special schools being there, it gives an excuse for mainstream schools to not change, because there's always somewhere else for those kids to go.
A 2017 report by the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare found students are increasingly attending special schools. In 2015, there were 15% of students with a disability nationally who attended a special school, up 35% from 2003. Linda Graham says that's a worrying trend and believes the benefits of inclusive education go far beyond the classroom.
Nobody is asking, well, what happens after you get out of a special school? Where do you go? The research shows that that trajectory leads to other forms of segregation, like sheltered workshops and, you know, group homes and things like that. The better quality of education that you get, the better you will be able to be an independent and valued human being in the community.
Professor Linda Graham from the Queensland University of Technology. Julia Holman, our reporter. Well, an Australian horse called Vow and Declare has won the 159th Melbourne Cup in a victory for Australia's racing industry against a field of mostly international competitors. But the last-placed horse, Rostropovich, is not in a good way. Its trainers say it has an injured pelvis but should make a full recovery. The race has been celebrated around Australia by some, but also actively not celebrated by others, as recent animal cruelty revelations put a bomb under the industry. Our reporter Isabel Rowe has been gauging opinion in Melbourne.
Master of Reality just in front. Vow and Declare kicked. Vow and Declare's got it.
Plenty of bets placed, but few winners to be found at this Melbourne bar.
I think I had money on Vow and Declare. I'll have to put my glasses on. I had him in a trifecta. Oh. But that's okay. Have you I don't know anything about horses, so I look at the names.
Did you put any money on?
Yes, we did.
What are you betting on?
Finch, Surprise Baby.
Well, we always celebrate the cup, but we're from Sydney, really. So
you've come especially?
We've come especially for it.
Have you put a bet on?
Unfortunately, we haven't, actually.
There's been sort of talk about animal welfare issues and stuff this year. Do you ever think about that?
That's probably one of the reasons why I didn't rush out to bet this year, because with the latest information that's come out regarding how the horses are treated, racehorses in particular, I just haven't been comfortable.
Yeah, I'm celebrating the same way, but it's always good to see the administration talking about doing more things for the horses. That's very important too.
What do you love about the Melbourne Cup?
It's just the atmosphere and the fashion, and you have a drink and it's just a great day out. And you meet lovely people.
It's a public holiday in Melbourne, and while CBD stores are open, they're mostly empty. The bars, pubs and restaurants are packed though. Melbourne Cup events are big earners for the venues. Others went to the race course itself, some as early as 7 a.m.
I'm Kathy. My name's Kathy.
So tell me about this setup here. You have breakfast in the car park, yes. And then you go in.
Yes, yes we do. Right. Yes, we do. It's a lovely way to start the day with champagne, chicken, toasts to family and friends. So it's an excellent way to start the day. Happy cup day.
But the cup isn't for everyone. Dozens of people have come to this brewery in the Melbourne suburb of Fitzroy instead. They're not dressed in their finery, and the races aren't on the television either. They're saying nup to the cup.
We've come here to Fixation to say no to the cup, nup to the cup. There is really nothing glamorous or beautiful about the racing industry, either horses or greyhounds. I just think it's revolting the way it's completely normalised in this culture. I was lightheartedly saying to my friends that I won't, and my colleagues, that I won't be at work because, you know, Victoria has a public holiday to celebrate animal cruelty, and there's sort of awkward laughter.
I always felt strongly about it because I don't gamble, don't do anything like that, and I don't see the necessity for abuse to creatures that have no say in it.
Have you come here before?
No.
I've followed a few of the events over the years, but I haven't got anything. Yesterday I went to my first the Horse Racing Kills protest at the Melbourne Cup Parade, and then wanted to come along to an Up to the Cup thing today as well.
Michael Craig runs the restaurant hosting the event.
Yeah, we're definitely getting a bigger response so far this year. I think we've got about 250 people booked in tonight, and so throughout the day we're aiming to do about 500 pizzas is what we're looking at, so it's definitely going to be one of our busiest days for sure.
Proceeds of Nup to the Cup events go to the Coalition for the Protection of Racehorses, the animal rights group that's led protests during this year's Spring Racing Carnival.
Isabel Rowe, our reporter in Melbourne today. You're listening to PM, I'm Linda Mottram. Shortly, we'll ask whether the government's new highly skilled migration program is the economic turbocharger that's claimed, or another sugar hit for lazy employers, as one economist suggests.
Employers have gotten lazy. They expect to just advertise an opening and expect 10 or 20 or 30 job-ready applicants to appear the next morning. Now, they've forgotten their responsibility to carefully and patiently develop their own workforce over time.
China's President Xi Jinping has given an assurance to the global business community that his country will reduce trade barriers that curb access to the world's biggest market. For a second straight year, he's convened a major trade fair in Shanghai as the trade dispute with the US continues. But Chinese officials have already had to reject claims by some Western business groups of promise fatigue about China's willingness to really open its economy. Here's our China correspondent, Bill Birtles.
Please all rise and give a round of warm applause as President Xi Jinping of the People's Republic of China.
Xi Jinping created the Shanghai Import Expo last year to show the world China's huge domestic market is open for business. It was partly an effort to portray China as a champion of free trade amid a bruising trade war with the US. 12 months on, with the trade dispute still going, he's trying again.
China has close to 1.4 billion people. The mid-level income group is the world's largest. The scale and potential is huge. The future outlook, unlimited. The Chinese people have a saying, "The world is so large, I want to take a look." Well, today I say, China's market is so large, I welcome everyone to come and have a look.
At home, Chairman Xi regularly hails the superiority of socialism with Chinese characteristics and throws his weight behind huge state-owned companies. But when speaking to foreign leaders and business types, President Xi sings a very different tune.
We will speed up the new framework of openness. China will continually improve the market, legal and international business environment.
Last year, a European business group slammed his speech as repeating old promises, while offering little new in the way of reciprocal market access. At the heart of the US-China trade dispute are complaints that China has managed to convince other nations to drop trade barriers where it has an advantage, like electronics and manufacturing, while blocking foreign firms in areas where they have an advantage, like financial services and tech companies. James McGregor is a Shanghai-based US businessman and a former head of the American Chamber of Commerce in China.
They have made some changes, but some of the ones they've made so far are also in China's interest. You know, opening up financial services more because they've already dominated the market, and they need to clean it up with best practices, so let the foreigners come in and have a sliver of the market, things like that.
In the coming weeks, Xi Jinping and US President Donald Trump are expected to sign a Phase 1 trade deal. Critics say it's really just China buying more US agricultural goods, which it needs anyway. But James McGregor says the US pressure is having some effect.
They need foreign capital. I mean, they got a lot of money here, but a lot of it is tied up in all kinds of obligations, you know, with all the Belt and Road and all the other things and all the infrastructure spending. So, you know, I hate to give Trump credit for anything, but the pushback has had an effect here.
For Australia, China is a much more simple proposition. The vast bulk of Australia's trade involves selling resources, farm products, or education and tourism. And that's why 200 Australian companies, plus the Trade Minister, Simon Birmingham, are in Shanghai for the Trade Expo. They'll be hoping Xi Jinping's promises for greater access to 1.4 billion people are fulfilled. This is Bill Birtles in Beijing, reporting for PM.
Well, China was the initiator of a major new Asia-Pacific trade deal that took big steps forward towards fruition at a regional summit in Bangkok this week, but the deal does have its critics. If the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP, is finalised in the next year, it would cover 15 Asia-Pacific states, including Australia, making up 29% of the global economy. Alan Oxley was a long-serving international trade diplomat and advisor. He's chair of the Australian APEC Study Centre at RMIT University, and he's managing director of trade consultancy ITS Global. We spoke first about what the deal might mean for Australia, but also what it says about the Southeast Asian states that are on board.
Well, the importance is they're accepting that they need to do a little bit more to open their markets for trade. The reality with most of the ASEAN countries is that They still have got a number of restrictions on imports. They're still not free to encourage foreign investment, which is now probably a bit more important than tariffs. So these are things that they need to move along, and at least ASEAN, the ASEAN group, provides a framework for to do that. For us, the actual returns are fairly modest. It's really a matter of Australia being engaged in this sort of thing and seeing if we can encourage even more liberalisation by the member states.
Now, India is holding out. Are their concerns legitimate around a flood of Chinese goods? China is, of course, going to sign up if it happens, and their own tariff structure.
Well, they've got a different problem, which they don't talk about much. In India, most of the responsibility for trade lies in the state governments, not the national government. And that's the major problem the national government has, that it can't control. There's a lot of influence exerted by big business in India, and they're not really interested in opening their markets. So they've stepped away, which is actually quite good, because their attitude has been, you should be going along with what we want to do. What they want to do has never been wholly consistent, where even the ASEANs wanted to head. I mean, India's got this typical syndrome that big economies have, where they're fairly large, they can actually get by without having to open their markets. Their business figures are very powerful. The Indian government often, when it comes to business, doesn't have a lot of control over the way in which business decisions are taken.
Now, what about the RCEP agreement itself, even without India? The criticisms of this and other similar big trade deals are around, well, there's a whole lot of things, but the secrecy of negotiations is one point, publics not being able to see what's going on. Do you accept that's a fair criticism?
No, I don't. It's often talked about, particularly by people who don't like trade liberalisation, but to claim that they don't know what's going on, they can't see things, is really, I think, a sort of political grumble rather than a real fact.
One of the other details is around investor-state dispute settlement, where big companies can take sovereign governments to rather opaque processes to settle disputes, the fear that sovereignty is traded off to companies. How do you view those?
This is a position which is taken by the ACTU and the unions. It's not credible. And it's a highly political position. It actually never makes much in the way of sense, because the ISDS proposals, which aren't actually being run all over the place, it's only been in some agreements where they apply, are supported by businesses, are supported by the governments. And we've got this strange situation here in Australia where the union movement, which has been the major push on this, seems to think it's something that you shouldn't be engaged with. And it really has no rational basis.
And just finally, the other element here is China's security behaviour, particularly in the South China Sea. China insists it's not going to cede an inch of territory there. Should China be rewarded by being included in a big trade deal like RCEP if it's continuing to, as some see it, bully smaller nations in the region?
No, look, the key thing here, which is a fact of life with international relations, and to a degree I think has been skirted over and put aside, security and trade issues are separate, are traditionally treated as separate. And you might have noticed that while China has been quite unhappy with some of the general statements that have been made by the Australian government, they haven't ceased to bring Australian imports in. They still regard iron ore exports as a major important product. And that's actually the reality. When we look over time at these relationships, it's not too often that a major country will invoke a security concern when there are major trade interests at stake.
Trade consultant and former diplomat Alan Oxley. The federal government has announced a new visa fast-track scheme for highly skilled workers, but leading academics say it threatens to further entrench underemployment and low wage growth. The government, though, is selling the migration scheme as an economic turbocharger set to boost key sectors like fintech and manufacturing. So, who's right? Our business reporter David Taylor has been trying to get the answer.
It's called the Global Talent Independent Program, fast-tracking thousands of overseas industry pros to supercharge the economy. Immigration Minister David Coleman.
We want to get the best and the brightest people to Australia, especially in high-growth industries.
It's got the backing of some of Australia's most successful companies, including Cochlear and Atlassian. The scheme will target as many as 5,000 high-income earners a year, with expertise in one of seven fields, including medical technology, cybersecurity, fintech and space travel.
When those very highly skilled migrants join Australian businesses, they invariably come up with ideas and projects and initiatives that lead to the employment of more Australians and the growth of those Australian businesses, and that's a very positive thing.
Look, I think this is quite a worrying trend. Australia has relied far too long on importing the skills, and these are skills we could be developing in our own country.
That's Marion Baird. She heads up Sydney University's Work and Organisational Studies program. She slammed the policy as short-sighted and says it imposes unfair competition on highly skilled Australian workers.
We can't keep doing that every year, and soon we'll be in competition with other countries trying to bring in skills as well.
The university's business school has come up with its own solution to tackling big problems like job insecurity and low wage growth. It's developing a new course that's expected to churn out roughly 100 industrial relations experts annually. Skilled policy workers, the uni says, that'll be equipped to solve the problems dogging workers now for years.
Look, we can't be the direct causal link, but we can certainly say that what you learn in this course will enable you to go out and improve productivity, efficiency and performance in Australian workplaces, but understanding that we need to have fairness and equity in that process as well.
Independent economist Jim Stanford supports what Sydney University is trying to achieve with its new course, but he argues the problems plaguing Australia's labour force lie squarely with what he calls lazy employers, which, he says, the government's migration program may only further encourage.
There are about 3 million Australians who are unemployed or underemployed. And many of those 3 million Australians have got tremendous skills, yet their skills are not in demand at this moment from employers here. Employers have gotten lazy. They expect to just advertise an opening and expect 10 or 20 or 30 job-ready applicants to appear the next morning. They've forgotten their responsibility to carefully and patiently develop their own workforce over time. Then, when they suddenly need someone, they throw up their hands and say, oh my gosh, there's a skills shortage. Government, bail me out with some more temporary migrants. It's a very short-sighted and ultimately ineffective way to address the skills needs of our economy.
The government says the new additions will enter Australia as part of the annual skill migration cap of 70,000, which is part of the overall immigration intake of 160,000.
David Taylor with that report. Well, the New South Wales government has got it, the New South Wales Parliament has got it, but the public isn't getting it. There's to be no public release of the list of 444 buildings in that state that are clad in flammable material that the Firefighters Union says could result in a major incident. The state government's refusal to publish is leading to calls for the federal government to step in and take leadership of an issue that's beginning to politically snowball. Here's political reporter Tom Eagledon.
If the New South Wales government's hoping to quell public fear by refusing to publish the list of buildings clad in flammable material, it's not working, says the New South Wales Tenants Union. Leo Patterson-Ross is the union's policy officer.
In the absence of really clear information and really clear action, people do tend to try and fill in the gaps. And they can get it wrong, either not take it seriously enough or get overly worried about the potential risks. And that's probably not helped by claiming that, you know, there's arson that's waiting in the wings to burn down the building.
The threat of arson and terrorism are the reasons the government cites for not releasing the list. Regulations Minister Kevin Anderson wasn't available for an interview, but a spokesman told PM keeping the public safe is the first priority.
If anything, that argument is a really good argument for government to get active on removing the dangerous cladding as quickly as possible.
And what is the latest information that you have about that process?
We are pretty in the dark, to be honest.
The state government's moving to try and get the information to residents on the down low. It's written to landlords telling them to tell their tenants, and it's recently begun trying other methods to directly contact those who could be in harm's way.
If it's a door-knocking campaign and you're not home or you're very busy, these things aren't foolproof.
And says Leo Patterson-Ross, dealing with the issue would be easier if everyone had the information.
And it would be good if organisations like ours and other legal advisers could check on a public register to make sure when a client calls and says, I heard something about my building having a problem, we can check and we can confirm with them what their rights are.
And it's not just renters being kept in the dark. David Shoebridge is a Greens Upper House MP in the State Parliament.
There's no specific requirement under the conveyancing laws for future purchases to be toll or about flammable cladding. It's not required to be provided under what's called a Section 149 certificate. And when it comes to places where you work or places where you visit, there's absolutely no notification in place.
And he says it's time for the federal government to step in.
When those state governments are failing to act and failing to take consistent steps to protect consumers and to establish a good baseline for the industry so that there's confidence in the construction industry, well, that becomes a national problem.
Leighton Drury is the state secretary of the Fire Brigade Employees Union.
Someone needs to take control of this issue and drive it. And that's what we're not seeing.
He says there are parallels between the Grenfell Towers fire in London in 2017 that killed 72 people after cladding on the building caught alight.
They went to self-regulation. They cut budgets of the fire service in London. They absolutely decimated the workforce over there. And we're seeing the same thing occur in New South Wales.
He says the state government shared the information with firefighters about the location of the 444 buildings.
If it comes up on our system that this is one with cladding, we will upgrade that response.
Leighton Drury of the New South Wales Fire Brigade Employees Union, Tom Iggledon, our reporter. When elders in the Central Australian community of Willowra get lost in the bush, they don't reach for a map, they start singing a song. A map in a song, songlines as they're known. They help people in the remote town find water, tell stories and navigate through space. But in recent times, people in the town started to see these songs being forgotten. So they've taken it upon themselves to start archiving them. Oliver Gordon reports.
On a hot afternoon in the Willowra Community Centre, people huddle around a computer screen watching a video of their elders singing ancient cryptic songs. Elder George Ryder is one of the few people left in this town that has a good grasp of these songs, and he's trying to translate them. This song has been sung by people moving between the Top End and Central Australia for generations. It describes different landscapes like hills, waterholes and plains, and the stories and rituals that are intrinsic to them. But knowledge of songlines like this one has been fading away for decades. Now, the town is uniting to save the information stored in these songs.
They've been singing where we go and visit the sites, and they sing that place. Every socket we go, they sing that song.
Selena Williams is one of the people involved in the Willowra Mapping Project. She's been joining elders like George Ryder on expeditions to follow songlines, before documenting them on a 3-metre canvas map.
Yeah, we've been going, visiting the sites, putting it in a map and named all the places that we visit and all the sites and putting it into a map. And the map's looking really good.
When laid out on the ground, the canvas takes up half the community room floor. Bright blue paint marks the main landmark, the Landa River. It runs down the centre of the map, and small sites marked by neat black handwriting are peppered alongside it. There are the waterholes, rock features, sandhills and sacred sites that were once only recorded in the songlines.
So Teddy Long is an elder here who had a vision of creating a map that could be a teaching tool for the younger generations.
Petronella Varzon-Morell worked in the Willowra School 40 years ago and is now one of the anthropologists helping on the project.
He and a lot of the elders were actually worried about many of the elders passing away and the gap that this would leave, the changes in the world, the lack of opportunities for people to go back on country. He came up with this idea of a mapping project.
That was more than 10 years ago. And now the canvas is full of spots that might have otherwise been forgotten.
Seeing the teaching tool, you witness the way that the elders are sort of telling younger people about where their places are and discussing the dreaming tracks that connect them. It's incredibly exciting.
Her excitement is shared by high school student Sean Kitson, who plans to visit the sacred sites and take photographs.
Yeah, we're trying to pause it on. We're going to put it on the Google map. Yeah, we'll put them on Google, yeah. Just the world to see, the world to know.
High school student Sean Kitson with our reporter Oliver Gordon. I'm Linda Mottram. That is PM for today. You can always find us at the ABC Listen app and wherever you get your podcasts. That's where you should subscribe and leave us a review too. AM and The World Today are also there, so subscribe to them and leave them a review as well. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hey there, I'm Chris Dengate.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
Visit Australia, see the country, get paid in the process. It's a strong pitch for tourists who get drawn into the Working Holiday Maker program. But doing it for $3 an hour is a slightly harder sell.
Today's episode is all about the sometimes hellish pay and treatment waiting for tourists once they arrive for their 88 days of work in regional and rural areas.
That's The Signal, every weekday morning on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.